Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit with my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her.
From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, welcome to Yen Radio. Today's show is an encore presentation of pieces that first aired September 20th, 2007. It's called Animal Attraction. We're going to hear from Jane Goodall about chimps and dogs, from John Katz about a border collie named Devin. We'll have a piece about an Egyptian cat goddess, Bastet. And I'm going to start the show with one of my impressions from Nepal. It's called Animal Roads and Monkey Temples. But we're going to set the scene with music from The Cranberries. This is called Animal Instinct.
Thank you.
Installment 1 on today's show, Animal Attraction, Animal Roads and Monkey Temple. In a foreign town filled with people going about their business on busy streets, most people are on foot, many on bicycles, some motorcycles, but still plenty of cars. All this traffic sharing the same potholed city roads as fast as they can go without colliding. So that's not very fast, actually. But there's whizzing and whirring sounds and voices calling and greeting and brakes squealing. And then a new sound came to my American ears. Coupled with the clip, clop, clop, clop of hooves. During my visit to Nepal, I was impressed with the animal-human interactions because they were just so different than ours. There were no dogs on leashes. Dogs were mangy scavengers, not to be trusted, except perhaps by the rare owner, for whom they worked as a guard dog. But most were neighborhood strays, who occasionally scuffled with other dogs that wandered into their territories. The donkeys and oxen with larger bells and deeper tones, they shared the streets with the cars, with people on foot, with bicycles, with motorcycles. When the bells announced a donkey train coming your way, you tried to beat the train, otherwise you'd be waiting for it to pass, because donkeys and oxen have the right-of-way. The cows wandered around, picking up what food they could find or what was offered. Like the reputed cows of India, they were not butchered or hassled, but they're allowed to wander as they please, perhaps because they're sacred. But they were dirty, and they were skinny, and sometimes sickly. Is this a way to keep sacred creatures? In Kathmandu, one of our first stops was the famous Monkey Temple. We were warned not to take food up to the temple, even as an offering. So at the bottom of the temple, two of us women who were in our Sierra Club group bought a couple of candles and some chrysanthemums to offer. Then we started to climb up the temple steps, perhaps 5 flights up. I don't remember for sure, but it looked really steep and long. We were barely started when we began to see monkeys, though. They were cute little guys. And gals, too, obviously, as one was carrying a baby. She walked on her arms and her legs, and the little one hung underneath her. It was clinging to her belly. Both of us watched both of the monkeys, all the monkeys, the mom, the dads, the baby, watch me intently, as though my height and my whiteness made me an obvious mark. My partner and I startled and jumped and squealed as it dashed off. It was just one of them running at us, and then another one came. And what did they want from us? Then one got too close, and it scratched me a little bit as it came flying right by my hand. It was my hand. It was my hand holding the chrysanthemums for an offering. I dropped them really quickly and created a monkey frenzy by dropping them. These wild creatures swiped at the flowers up and started eating them. So much for bringing an offering. And we failed in the not bringing food department, too, even though we thought we were just bringing flowers. At the top of the temple, the Hindus made offerings of colored dyes and candles at many of the shrines. Monkeys guarded the shrines and tried to swipe anything shiny and edible before those who tended the shrine could grab it and safeguard it. This was a shared temple, and next to the Hindu shrines were rows of prayer wheels, and the Buddhist monks in crimson robes were among the people spinning the wheels as they passed, the wheels always on the right side. The monkeys hadn't yet chosen between Hinduism and Buddhism, and it made the most of both of what both offered to them. The Hindus offered food in their offerings and flowers, but the Buddhists offered entertainment. Because the monkeys ran along these prayer flags that were strung from the steeples, occasionally loosening one end to create a giant swing. They'd jump and they'd swing, and they'd hang from the string of prayer flags. Jump and swing and jump and chatter, until eventually a monk would calmly take the loose end from the monkeys and reattach it. After hiking around in some of the rural regions of Nepal and yielding to numerous donkey trains along the way, I ended up back in the small city of Pokhara again, separate from the outing group due to the wonderful diversity of critters in the water. Yeah, I got the traveler's bane, some intestinal bug that wiped me out so I couldn't keep up with the group. So I went back to the city to recover and arrived just in time for the festival, Diwali. This was a festival of dancing in the street and of lights and so many other things, but it also was a festival of animals. It is a festival of animals. It should be coming up soon. It's a fall festival. I had missed the first day of the five-day festival. The first day was the day that they honored the crow. The day that I arrived was the day to honor dogs, I was told. But I just slept, at least until evening, when the singing and the boomboxes and the dancing and the candles lit up all the neighborhoods. The third day, I was eating a brunch when I saw three ladies. They were shopkeepers across the street. They came out to one of the wandering cows and gave her some food and marked her with dyes. They took some empty tin cans, dipped in them dry dyes that were like chalk powder, and made circular decorations on the cow in bright colors. I remember mostly pinks and bright blues. Like the proper tourist, I got up, of course, and got closer to the ladies to gawk and to take some pictures. For days, I saw cows with fading decorations, including wreaths of flowers around their necks that were called mala. The cows would chew these mala off, particularly if they were live flowers. They would chew off the chrysanthemums across each other's necks as they wandered through the streets. Then we went to the south, and the streets to the south, near the border with India and Tiger Country, were busier. I met up with a group, and we traveled with our group, and we traveled south to the national park to see tigers and rhinos and elephants. We arrived by jeep on rutted dirt roads shared by horse and mule-drawn carts, as well as the two-legged traffic, some better-behaved dogs than were up north, kids of all size and very curious, and elephants. Elephant traffic shared the road. But really for us, elephants were best for off-roading. We climbed atop elephants to plunge into the jungle, searching for even wilder animals. We did see a rhino, and that was cool, but we only heard a tiger. And that was still cooler. That tiger roared, and I understood how a sound could actually send chills down your back. A primal fear arose in the gut from the sound. All the other jungle sounds stopped. The roar made the whole area go suddenly still and quiet for a split second, and you could feel it down in your bones. But then the split second ended because the guides went wild. They were trying to give us tourists what we wanted, and they sent those elephants running toward those fearsome sounds. We didn't find one, but we could tell we were close from the sounds. But I still left quite satisfied with just that noise. Back home, I can only remember the sounds and the smells of the Nepal animals. I left with an impression of animals being so much more a part of life. Not really more so than they are for us, but they're more visible. And to help me remember, I brought back these donkey bells. And I can almost see those donkeys clomping down a cobbled road when I close my eyes and listen to the bells.
She might be found. Perhaps it's easier this way. Her talent might equal attention. Perhaps what is said can be done. And the patience isn't all there. She waits like someone. swaying on the trees from a childhood climbed and conquered. And she comes out of the hills and the valleys and into the city. I saw her walking outside of the old communist garden. I saw her walking down old Dictator Square. Past the lovers, almost coitus. They say she's the monkey lady. Some say she's coming back, some say she's leaving. Some say she's not from here, some say she's not from there. They say she's the monkey lady. Some say she's coming everywhere.
Some say she's not from here. Some say she's not from there. Some say she's not from here.
Meeting her is like playing football tonight.
Some say she's not from here. Some say she's not from there.
Some say she's not from there. Everything just slips away.
Some say she's not from here. Some say she's not from there.
They say meeting her is like playing football on ice.
Some say she's not from there.
She's the monkey lady. I've seen her in many cities, towns. She travels by train every day. She'll dance wild dances for you if you ask her in the right way. She'll climb all over you and take you to places.
The real monkey lady? Probably Jane Goodall. She was on the Palouse last March, and here's a brief piece from her lecture. I call this little excerpt, The Best Education.
I'd been in Gombe about a year when I went to college, and I was a little scared. You can imagine, can't you, going to do a PhD when you have never been to college at all. But I was excited, too, because I had all this data and I wanted to know how to analyze it. So you can imagine it was a bit shocking to get there and be told that I had done everything wrong. I shouldn't have given the chimpanzees names, they should have had numbers. It was more scientific. I couldn't talk about their personalities, that was unique to us. I certainly couldn't talk about them having minds capable of any kind of thought. That was also unique to the human species. And as for talking about emotions, I could not talk about chimpanzees feeling happy or sad or fearful or filled with despair, because these were unique to human, and attributing emotions similar to this to non-human animals was to be guilty of the terrible sin of anthropomorphism, attributing human characteristics to non-human beings. Well, I suppose I should have been utterly intimidated by all these erudite professors with all their statistics and years of study. But you know, I thought back to my childhood, and now I come to the next individual who played such an important role in who I am today. And all through my childhood, I had this extraordinary teacher, and he absolutely taught me clearly that animals had personalities, that they had minds, that they were capable of thinking, and that they absolutely had emotions and feelings. Who was that teacher? My childhood companion, my dog, Rusty.
Jane Goodall spent some time at a press conference prior to that lecture. in this little next clip, she responds to my question about how animals affected her spiritually.
Dr. Goodall, with Yin Radio, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, I wanted to talk about the spiritual side, which you may have just touched on when you talked about inspiring. Your PBS special with the same title as your talk tonight is subtitled A Spiritual Journey. What's spiritual about it? Is it connections with animals, environment, people?
I was brought up in a Christian family. We weren't religious, particularly. My grandfather was actually a minister, but I never met him. He died before I was born. And, so we went to church sometimes, and God was kind of something that we talked about. I had an amazing mother who used to say, you know, if you'd been born in Egypt, you would talk about Allah. And if you'd been born in China, you'd talk about Tao or something. So she believed there was one God. And then when I was in the forest at Gombe, I was there for a long time alone. And so I had this real feeling that there was a great spiritual power. And, you know, I have no other word but God to call it, whatever it is. It seems to be something stronger than me. And it's been very interesting over the years that people, every time we find the chimps doing something, which we used to think only we could do, a lot of intellectual things, using and making tools, all these things. Always there's then a new definition. Well, at least this is unique to humans. And they've now come round to the soul. Well, only humans have souls. Well, for one thing, we can't prove that we have souls. I mean, I don't think anybody can. We can't prove it scientifically. And the sort of feeling I got when I was out in the forest is that there's a little spark of this great spirit power in each living thing. And because we humans love to analyze and label things, we've decided that that is a soul. And if it's a soul in us, then I think the chimpanzees also have souls, and dogs, you know. I mean, that's just me. This is nothing scientific. It's just you ask me what. That's how I feel.
Jane Goodall.
Locked us up, peaches. We're locked inside this soup. Your bananas get thrown at me, and mine get thrown at you. Every night we fuss and fight like Arabs and like Jews. I guess love is always just. Love is monkey see and monkey do. That's all it is, peaches. Love is monkey see, monkey do. Would I lie to you? Love is monkey see and monkey do. That's all it is, peaches. Love is monkey see and monkey do. Do, do, do. Do you want my love, peaches? Or do you want my rage? Or do you merely like to see me shake my cage? Your papayas get thrown at me, and mine get thrown at you. I guess love is always just. Love is monkey see and monkey do. That's all it is, peaches. Love is monkey see and monkey do. Would I lie to you? Love is monkey see and monkey do. That's all it is, peaches. Love is monkey see and monkey do. Monkey see and monkey do. That's all it is, peaches. Love is monkey see and monkey do.
Sweet smelling pillow, ease my weary head. But your big dog was laying there, snoring loud as he pleased. I say, if I lay down with that dog, I'll get up with fleas. You said the dog was here first. That's what you told me. You said the dog was here first. Yeah, you said the dog was here first. If you don't like it, you can leave. But babe, I want to share your life. Sit down for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Eat some home-cooked food. I'll be your sweet bread winner. I pulled out a chair. I heard a growl and a moan. The dog had grabbed my leg and made like it was his bone. You said the dog was here first. That's what you told me. You said the dog was here first. Yeah, yeah, you said the dog was here first. If you don't like it, you can leave. Well, you said this was your baby, the only child you had, your companion and your partner. How could I be mad? Your dog was always with you through thick and through thin. Soon I came to understand he was your only friend. But I still want to share your life, so I'll bring your dog some treats. I'll scratch behind his ears, I'll shake hands with his feet. Your dog would run and greet me, he'd sit up and he'd beg. Then drool run out of his mouth and he'd start to hold my leg. You said the dog was here first, that's what you told me. The dog was here first, yeah, yeah. You said the dog was here first. If you don't like it, you can leave. Your dog was always with you through thick and through thin. Soon I came to understand he was your only friend. But I still want to share your life, so I'll bring your dog some treats. I'll scratch behind his ears, I'll shake hands with his feet. Your dog would run and greet me, he'd sit up and he'd beg. Then he'd sniff my crotch and start to hold my leg. You said the dog was here first, that's what you told me. You said the dog was here first. Oh yeah, yeah, you said the dog was here first. If you don't like it, you can leave. Oh my goodness, oh my goodness, I think you love this dog more than you love me. Yeah, I know he was here first, but I mean, oh my goodness. Ooh, oh, oh boy, that was a rough one. I can't take it, I can't take much more than this. Hey, I love you and all that, but I'm out of here.
Our installment number 3 comes from a man named John Katz, who writes about dogs. He's written a lot about dogs, and he's had a number of bestsellers. The most recent one is called A Good Dog. It's a story of Orson, a dog who changed his life, but he begins with a prologue about a dog called Devon. I'm going to read a brief portion of that for you. My neighbor came pounding at the back door. Devin is over at the school, she shouted. He's got a school bus trapped. They've called the police. You better get down there. I didn't need to hear more. Ever since I brought him home, this new dog, Devin, was mesmerized by New Jersey's vast supply of things to herd and chase, things he'd never seen back in rural Texas. Kids on skateboards and scooters, garbage trucks and snowplows, and buses. He particularly loved buses. Devin herded school buses at every opportunity. He could hear their throaty engines blocks away and began circling, offering the famed border collie eye. He had chased buses several times, once or twice halting them in the middle of the street. By now, my wife and daughter and neighbors were used to seeing me tear after him through yards and across lawns, cursing and screaming, "Come and hear and stop," and anything I could think of to get his attention. Invariably, I failed. Once I rushed out in horror to see him clamped onto a moving school bus tire, hanging on while his body thumped onto the asphalt and then off. Fortunately, the bus was moving slowly. Devin was brave and determined in his own way, and I was slowly grasping that my yard and its wooden picket fence were only mildly diverting amusements for him. He could burrow under the fence, nose its wooden slats apart, or, if all else failed, simply sail over it. So I ran to the Red Brick Elementary School a couple of blocks from my home in Montclair, New Jersey. I could hear Devin barking as I got close. A knot of anxious mothers had gathered there, agitated and upset. Montclair is not the kind of town that chuckles at the antics of demented border collies, especially when kids and school buses are involved. Devin was charging purposefully at the closed door, nipping as if the bus were a giant sheep, while the kids peered out the window, shouting, and the driver held the door closed with his foot. Devin was a working dog with a purpose. Outside, several mothers were circling their chicks, poking and stomping at Devin, crying, "Get off! That dog is dangerous," I heard one woman yell. "Did you call the police?" The more the screaming intensified, the more excited and determined Devin seemed to become. He wasn't about to be run off by soccer moms or a bellowing bus driver. I rushed up behind him, shouting, "It's okay, he's my dog. He won't hurt anybody." I even announced that he was a rescue dog, usually a surefire way to win sympathy and support. But my reassurance didn't seem to ease the mothers' minds, and I can't say I blamed them. I knew Devin wouldn't hurt the kids, but how could they know? I heard sirens in the not-too-distant distance. Could they really be coming for us? A red-faced teacher or administrator shouted, "Here come the police! Get back!" For somebody who had two mellow and responsive yellow Labradors, dogs whose great passions were eating and sleeping, this was high canine drama. I seemed to have suddenly acquired the John Dillinger of dogs. The siren sounded nearby as I rushed up behind Devin. I seized him by the collar and whacked him on the butt to get his attention. Startled, he looked at me, seeming to snap out of his trance. I'd neglected to grab a leash, so I picked him up, yelling silly platitudes to the angry parents and school officials. "What is wrong with you?" I hissed to this impossible dog. Then, I can't recall my thoughts, if I had any besides a vague fear that Devin would be marched off to the local animal shelter and imprisoned, perhaps even killed. I ran. I took off, dog in arms, fleeing from the shouting kids, the ticked-off bus driver, and especially from the police. My only previous run-ins with the law had been traffic tickets. Now I and my dog were fugitives. Huffing and puffing, Devin probably weighed close to 50 pounds. I scuttled between the houses across from the school and then zigzagged like a burglar up driveways, down alleys, through lovingly tended backyards. Dogs barked, cats fled, a few people stuck their heads out their windows and stared. One thing going for me was that New Jersey suburbs are densely built with lots of gardens and garages to hide in. The people whose property I was invading wouldn't know we were on the lam. They probably just assumed I was crazy. The sirens got closer. I prayed for a water main break or a fender bender, anything to distract the police. Surely they had more important things to do. But then the sirens stopped, suggesting the police had arrived at the school and weren't rushing to some other crime scene. This dog had been through a lot, and I wasn't going to let him go to jail. Sweating, my heart pounding, I kept moving, taking refuge in a garage a few blocks from my house. I hoped my neighbors wouldn't turn me in. Most had become fond of Devin, sort of. They'd learned that although eccentric, he wasn't dangerous, but I couldn't head home without drawing close to the school, risking apprehension by what I imagined was a burgeoning army of law enforcement and animal control officials. I could only guess how this was playing over police radios. crazed dog attacking children outside school. So I pushed Devin into a corner. Holding him by the collar, I crouched down with him. He licked my face frantically, a bit alarmed, I think, by my excited and fearful demeanor. Devin had a genius for getting into trouble, yet he also seemed to startle him that he had done wrong and upset me. The world appeared to make no sense to him. "Don't move or I will beat you senseless, you crazy son of a bitch," I muttered. "You can't go hurting school buses. You just can't. That was not a sheep." Looking at him, I was struck again by what a beautiful dog he was, black and white with a pronounced blaze on his chest, and by how much I had come to love him in so short a time. He had an elegant thin nose. His eyes were intense and beautiful, deep and black, and I saw a sweetness and sorrow in them, existing side by side with his craziness, which never failed to touch my heart. He seemed to expect to fail, a tough burden for a proud working dog. I wanted to help him succeed. That was From a Good Dog by John Katz. Now we're going to move to Katz and Bastet. She was a goddess of ancient Egypt, and she was a cat. Elise Krieger talked about Bastet, the cat goddess, to a group of kids at the public library. Here's Elise Krieger.
Greetings. I am representing Bastet, the cat goddess of ancient Egypt. I know you've studied ancient Egypt, the land of the pyramids, the land of the desert and the hot sun, and very much a land of mystery and magic. And ancient Egypt was also a land full of animals, all kinds of animals. And the people of ancient Egypt loved animals, and they also loved children. They had their homes full of animals, monkeys, parrots, cats, dogs, even the occasional pet alligator, maybe even a baby cheetah. So they did love animals so much that sometimes when their children were born, they would name the child after an animal, one of their favorite animals. And there's actually a documented story of twins. 5-year-old twins were found in a tomb. And they had the same name. The name was Miet. Can you say that? Miet. Miet. And it means little cat. So when the twin girls were born, their parents couldn't decide which one to name little cat because they loved cats so much and they loved their little twin girls so much that they gave them both the same name. So can you imagine calling Miet, Miet? And both girls would come running. But we know that is a documented story. They loved children and animals so much that they just had pets running all over the place. Now, for example, who here likes to jump? You like to jump? Okay, your name might be Monkey. Who's a fast runner? Your name might be, what? Cheetah. Right, right. Who has a great big toothy grin? Let's see it. Let's see that toothy grin. Oh, yes, you might be Crocodile. And who likes to howl like a wolf? Yes, well, guess what? Your name might be Wolf. So that's how much the Egyptians loved animals and loved children. They loved life. They loved the sun, even though sometimes it got a little burny out in the desert. And they often had gods and goddesses who were represented with the body of a person and the head of an animal. You can probably think of an example right now.
I know of two of them. Bastet is one of them, and Anubis, right?
Oh, yes, Anubis. He was the
jackal-headed
god. Do you know why he was the god of the mummies and the death process? Do you know why? Because jackals were seen lurking around cemeteries at night, so the Egyptians put two and two together. Yes. What?
The Sphinx?
Yes, he's the mystery guy. The head of?
A lion.
Uh-huh.
The body of a man.
Yes. So, yes, the Egyptians had a lot of gods and goddesses that were heads of animals and bodies of people. But Bastet was actually the goddess that was much in favor for 2,000 years. She was given great powers by the Egyptians, and you can see she's decked out with all kinds of jewelry here. She was quite beautiful. And she was a very busy goddess, actually. She had a lot of jobs to do. Now, one of the things she had to do was to see everything. The Egyptians were actually afraid of the dark. Some of them were. And Bastet, that's right. Bastet represented cats who could see at night. Now, the Egyptian word for see or to see is mao. You want to say that word?
Mao.
And this is the hieroglyphic for M or to see, okay? So that's very cool. So now you can read Egyptian hieroglyphics, okay, next time you go to see the pyramids, all right? To see was extremely important to the Egyptians, as it is, of course, to us as well. And there were many reasons why Bastet was the goddess of the moon, because the moon has phases, as you know, and so does a cat's eyes. You ever watch a cat's eyes go back and forth? That's right, just like the moon. And cats could go out at night and see things that people couldn't see. And cats' eyes reflect the light of the moon, just as the moon reflects the light of the sun. So the Egyptians put all this together and decided that the cat was a pretty special creature and therefore should be elevated to the status of, hello, goddess. Yes. Bastet was also the goddess of the weather. She was in charge of getting good weather out for the crops, and you know that the which river, Nile River, was extremely important to development of farm life and the growth of crops. She was also the goddess of the harvest, which kind of goes together with the weather, doesn't it? And the reason she was the goddess of the harvest is because when it all began, oh, maybe 5 or 6,000 years ago, the Egyptians were some of the earliest farmers that we know of. And they grew their crops out in the very rich soil near the Nile River. And then they would gather the crops in, the corn and the wheat and so on, and put the crops into these big temple granaries. But guess what? At night, the rats would come in and eat the grain. And the Egyptians realized that there was something helping them. And it was a big desert cat called Felis silvestris. Can you say Felis silvestris? Yes. Yes, Felis silvestris. Well, this was a large cat, stood about this high, about the size of a bobcat. And it would come in and kill the rats. Well, the Egyptians were just excited about this very much so. So they started taming that animal. So what happened was with Felis silvestris, it wasn't the kind of cat you would want to take home with you. It wasn't a nice kitty at all. It had claws and sharp teeth. It was a desert cat. It was wild. So we have the Egyptians to thank for giving us our pet kitties. How many of you have kitties? You have kitties, yes. Well, thank you for the ancient Egyptians for giving us these animals, because what they did was over hundreds of years they bred the wild cat, got it smaller, got it more, shall we say, docile, and to the point where you could actually pick up the cat and put it in your lap, and it would be happy to stay there and not bite you. So, thank you, ancient Egyptians. So that's why Bastet was also the goddess of the harvest. Now, she had another job. I told you she was very important, goddess, very, very important. She had the job of being the goddess of hearth and home. Hearth, of course, is that nice little place in front of the fireplace, yes. And her biggest job was the protector of little children. So, for example, if you had a child at home that was sick, everyone in your house would cut off all their hair. Yes, they would cut off all their hair, and they would roll it up in a bag, and they would bring it to the jeweler. And the jeweler would weigh the hair, and the family would buy the weight of the hair in gold. They would bring the gold to the temple of Bastet and pray to Bastet to heal their sick child. And so that was another important job that Bastet had, was to keep children safe and well. Okay, now in ancient Egypt, there was a city called Bubastis. Can you say that, Bubastis? And Bubastis was a very, very famous city. There are the ruins now, and that's all we have left of it, but we know that it stood there. And in the center of Bubastis, in the middle of a lake, stood a temple made of red brick. And inside the temple were the cat goddesses. And the temple maidens brought them little fish from the Nile, cut up into little pieces, and bread soaked in milk, and they would take care of these cats every day, all the time. If you can imagine, the city of Moscow is built only to take care of the cats. Everybody in the city loves cats and takes care of cats. You go to City Hall down here, you walk in the door, guess what? All you see is cats.
Cats.
Cats, cats. There's a big statue of a cat in the center of City Hall. That's what Bubastis was. It was all about the cats. And they had a temple goddess whose name was Bastet. Now, she was a real cat, but cats do die. And after maybe 20 years or so, even though she was well taken care of, she would die. And so the temple priestesses would go out into the city and see who could be the next temple goddess. And everybody wanted their cat to be that cat. Now, if your cat died in your house, you would shave off your eyebrows. And you would go out into the town and people would say, oh, they would see your eyebrows shaved off. They'd say, oh, your kitty died, I'm so sorry. Now, when the temple goddess died, the cat goddess, then all the people in the entire city of Bubastis would shave their eyebrows and even sometimes the hair off their heads because they were so sad. That's Bubastis, and every year they'd have a big party in the spring, and people would sail up the Nile and down the Nile to go there to the party, and they'd bring their kittens with them. They'd just have a big party every spring. It was a big deal. Now, when your kitty died, you would take it to the embalmers. And they would make a mummy out of it. They would soak the cat's body in natron salts, just like they did for the person that would be, you know, that's right. And they would wrap the body in these linens. And after it was purified and dried out and all that, then they would paint a happy little face on the cat because they knew the cat was happy in the next life. If they were wealthy enough, they would also get some mice and have the mice mummified and buried in a little box next to their kitty. So the kitty would have playmates and something to eat in the next world. Scientists were out digging in the desert of Egypt recently, and they found graveyards and cemeteries full of mummified animals. So it was quite the thing. It was quite a thing to have your cat mummified, or your dog, or your monkey, because they loved animals so much. This is just a picture, by the way, of Bastet. And I'll just show you this quickly. This is the scarab she's wearing. How many of you know about the ancient scarab? The ancient Egyptians believed in the powers of the beetle. The ancient scarab beetle was actually a dung beetle. Do you know what dung is?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Anybody not know what dung is? Okay, well, it's, in a word, it's poop. Now, the dung beetle rolls the dung up a hill, up a sand dune. And the Egyptians would watch this. They were great observers of nature. And they would watch this process, and they would think that that looked like the rolling of the sun, the ball of the sun across the sky. They thought, wow, that must be a magic beetle, because it's rolling that ball of dung just like the sun is rolling across the sky. Well, guess what happened? Little beetles came out of that dung ball. The creation of life. Wow, this was big stuff. So the Egyptians decided that that little dung beetle was really special and really magic. So it became part of their religion, and they had many, many, many statues and pieces of jewelry made to represent the scarab beetle. So Bastet, of course, would wear that too as part of her jewelry attire. Bastet would often visit children and present them with a little gift. So I'd like you to pick out a kitten from Bastet. From Bastet's house to yours. And if you don't have a cat, I suggest you get one.
There's a man over there with a look of surprise, as much as to say, well, now, how about that? Do I actually see with my own very eyes a man who's not heard of a jellicle cat? What's a jellicle cat?
What's a jellicle cat?
The naming of cats is a difficult matter. It isn't just one of your holiday games. You may think at first I'm as mad as a hatter when I tell you a cat must have three different names. First of all, there's the name that the family use daily, such as Peter, Augustus, Alonzo, or James, such as Victor, or Jonathan, George, or Real Bailey. All of them sensible, everyday names. There are fancier names, if you think they sound sweeter. Some for the gentlemen, some for the dames, such as Plato, Admetus, Electra, Demeter, but all of them sensible, everyday names. But I tell you, a cat needs a name that's particular, a name that's peculiar, and more dignified. Else how can he keep up his tail perpendicular, or spread out his whiskers, or cherish his pride? Of names of this kind, I can give you a quorum, such as Monkey Strap, Craxer, or Corico Pat, such as Bombalurina, or S. Jelly Lorum, names that never belong to more than one cat. But above and beyond, there's still one name left over, and that is the name that you never will guess. The name that no human research can discover, but the cat himself knows and will never confess. When you notice a cat in profound meditation, the reason I tell you is always the same. His mind is engaged in a rapt contemplation of the thought, of the thought, of the thought, of his name, his ineffable, ineffable, and ineffable, deep and inscrutable, singular.
A good old friend, the best one that I've known. I've left her meowing by the door, but she always welcomed me home. My old cat, my old cat, tiger face and a Siamese hat, my old cat. My old cat was born down south, the climate got her down. She saw me coming a mile away and said, woman, get me out of this town. My old cat, my old cat, not your average Democrat, my old cat. My old cat never tied the knot, single all her life. Tomcat Charlie came to court, but she wouldn't be any Tom's wife. My old cat, my old cat, hop on up, let's have a chat. My old cat. My old cat's no traveling gal, she ain't no socialite. She'd rather read the books I read and sit on the letters I write. My old cat, my old cat, not can see it in her eyes. When dear Abby's in a jam, she calls her for advice. My old cat.
Thanks for joining me for this Yin Radio. You can contact Yin Radio at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Thanks to Jane Goodall, John Katz, and Elise Krieger for the content of today's show. We've heard music from the Cranberries, the American Watercolor Movement, Michael Franks, Gay Adegbalola, the cast of Cats from Broadway, and now Heidi Muller. Hope you've enjoyed today's show. Until next week.
My old cat, tiger face in a Siamese hat.